When I was a little boy and staying with my grandma, born in 1888, she would shut the bedroom window I'd opened and say, "Old Boney will come and get you." And I thought she was talking about a skeleton. But I guess her generation had shared a century with the man whose name she was using, as her mother had used before her, to frighten English children with. It's now 2 centuries since Napoleon Bonaparte cast a shadow over the European imagination. If Great Lives were a French radio programme, we wouldn't have got to Series 17 without tackling Napoleon I. And, you know, he wasn't even French. Not really. My guest this week is another man who, in the course of a distinguished broadcasting career, has also held the hopes of Europe in his hand.
Oh! And the game is on! They run back to their own respective door, followed by the sailor with a parrot on his shoulder. Everything is colour-coded. The Portuguese in orange, the Italians in blue, the Yugoslavs in beige, the French in the green. It's all over when the sailor, plus his sack of potatoes and the girl in the treasure chest and her sack, are behind the door.
Stuart Hall, commentating on Jeux Sans Frontières, the international version of It's a Knockout, like the Olympics in latex, if you can't remember. Stuart joined the BBC 50 years ago and has been a reporter, commentator and presenter on a wide range of radio and television programmes. In his 80th year, his football reports, with their gloriously unlikely metaphors and classical allusions, still brighten our Saturday tea times. Stuart, Napoleon may have divided historians, but he's your great hero. I understand you even have a collection of Napoleonic clocks.
Yes, I've got about 100 clocks.
What, 100?
Yes, I've got 100 clocks. And in my study, I have 3 Napoleonic clocks. The first one is a huge thing in bronze made in Paris with Napoleon mounting Marengo, his horse, just before Waterloo, and at his feet, in a very servile manner, his marchand, his faithful valet. And then the other one came down from Count von Esterhazy. This is fantastic. A 3-train Vienna clock in mahogany and boule.
Was it your love of Napoleon that brought you to the clocks, or your love of clocks that brought you to Napoleon?
My love of Napoleon I've had since I was a boy. Everybody has to have a role model, and when I was a child, I thought Napoleon must be my hero, because the world has been dominated by small men, small in stature, that is. You think of Hitler, Stalin, Alexander the Great, and for a small chap who wasn't even French, born in Corsica, his father was 18 years old, his mother was 14, and she had 13 children. And from such humble beginnings, the man conquered the whole of Europe. He conquered 20 countries, became King of France. He was incredible. What a man, what a man. He was mighty.
No one's going to dispute that he made a massive impact. Whether it was a good impact or not, we're going to discuss. And we've got 2 experts to call on, an Englishman in Paris and a French woman in London. Isabelle Toombs is a French historian who, with her husband Robert, wrote That Sweet Enemy, a history of the love-hate relationship between the French and the English. Isabel, does every French child grow up with the story of Napoleon?
Every child will remember that they study in secondary school Napoleon for 2 years, some with despair, some with pleasure, but I would tend to say more with despair. They go through all the battles.
Well, be silly. Why despair? Well, why not glory?
Well, yes, but some children find it slightly too much. I mean, as you said, the battles. Yes, he was a great man, but some French people might say, well, the battles went one step too far, for instance, in Russia, you could say. And they would like to insist on his earlier period of
Bonapartism. Let's start at the beginning. Don't finish with 1812 and the cannons and the defeat in Russia. Let's start with the early beginnings, when he was Bonaparte.
The person I want to bring in is Peter Hicks, who works at the Fondation Napoléon in Paris, running its website and providing a centre for Napoleonic scholars. Peter, there can be few characters in history who've inspired so many myths. What's your favourite?
Well, yeah, there seems to be a lot of myth slinging going on. My favourite is the one someone once asked me, is the reason that Napoleon put his hand in his waistcoat is because he had 6 fingers on his left hand and he was hiding it. Napoleon created the myth of himself, almost. I mean, when Napoleon was exiled to St Helena after Waterloo, he spent a lot of time writing, and he wrote the history how he wanted it to be, not in fact how it actually was, created what they call in French the légende, I mean, I take issue with this idea that he came from nowhere. I mean, there were three or four important families on Corsica, and the Bonapartes were one of them. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote an interesting essay in the 1850s. He says, the big attraction of Napoleon is he's like the quintessence of the self-made man. But that's what Napoleon himself tells about himself. It's not actually the case.
Whether he came from nowhere or not, he certainly symbolises, and I would agree with Stuart on this, meritocracy.
Precisely.
And the fact that whether he came from nowhere or not, he certainly rose to a very high position in society.
What did Napoleon look like, Peter?
Well, this idea of Napoleon being short comes out of British caricatures. He's apparently, according to research that's been done, he's about average height for a French man of the period. In his early years, during the Directory period, he was quite haggard. He had sort of sunken cheeks and was famous for sort of having slightly yellowy skin and not very well washed. Obviously, by the time we get to the coup d'etat of Brumaire, and he becomes first consul, then the costume changes.
We need to explain, Isabel, because you have no idea of the depth of ignorance of lots of Englishmen, including me, on French history. We need to explain that Napoleon himself wasn't in at the beginning of the French Revolution, but that the French Revolution had gone wrong. And Napoleon then, so to speak, picked up the pieces and took the reins. Is that right?
He became a bit of a Robespierre à cheval, a Robespierre on a horseback. I think his great achievement was to take the heritage of the revolution, or the positive heritage of the revolution, but he was a man of order. So basically, he reorganized France on the principle of the revolution, with, for instance, the Code Civil, made France orderly, but keeping the heritage of equality and meritocracy.
Well, meritocracy, because he quelled what could have been a civil war. The insurgents in Paris in 1795 were abandoned them, were all set to set fire to Paris, and he simply turned his cannon on them and annihilated them. And they said, the Directory said, right, OK, this fellow Napoleon is not the little yellow man that we all think he is. He's going to be the hero and take us forward, take France forward. They needed a hero. Everybody needs a hero.
Yes, we haven't yet established what established Napoleon as the great man that he was, which is his huge military prowess. He doesn't do so well at military college. What, Peter, is his first great military victory that establishes his name as a general or as someone who's going to become a general?
Well, obviously, it's the first Italian campaign.
Tell us about it.
The first Italian campaign in 1796. Napoleon ends up with a largely untrained group of men called the Armée d'Italie. He knocks them into shape, and he invents a new kind of battle, a sort of blitzkrieg, basically. You move fast, and he wins a series of significant battles and basically drives the Austrians out of northern Italy. He amazes the Austrians, and quite carefully he also writes about his own success.
When he went down, first of all, for his first army, went down to Nice, and there were 30,000 starving soldiers. And I quote here, he said, "I am to lead you to the most fertile plains in the world. Before you are great cities and rich provinces. There we shall find honour, glory and riches." He found riches because he was the first army, I think, to allow plunder, rape, arson and murder. They lived on the land. He was the first army to said, right, what's yours is mine, and he took it, whereas
that's a standard thing for all armies, isn't it?
The
30 Years' War laid waste to the same parts of Central Europe. Armies do that. Armies, when they go into town, it's a disaster. Everybody locks up their daughters and they hide.
But I think also Napoleon invented new tools. I mean, Wellington flogged these troops. Napoleon rewarded them after all. He certainly invented the Legion d'Honneur, and so he knew how to reward, certainly flogged, but possibly less than Wellington.
He knew how to reward with money.
And with money, of course.
He took great ransoms from the Italians and the Poles, the Russians, everybody he came into contact with. He held them to a ransom. But he did conquer 20 countries, the point is that he is a person of today. He tried to unify Europe.
I want to talk about the political achievements of Napoleon, Napoleonism. But just to stick for the moment with his military prowess, everybody agrees about his energy. Everybody agrees that he had inspirational qualities. But battle after battle, and we won't go through them all, but battle after battle, sometimes against insuperable or seemingly insuperable odds, this man seems to snatch victory from what looks like defeat. What were you commenting as a military historian, would you say the secret of Napoleon's military genius was?
Well, he was very clever with artillery. he went to the best inventors in France, and he lightened guns so that you could put them on a carriage and get over terrain that would frighten away most armies, that mud and ice and snow didn't frighten Napoleon. He went over the St. Bernard Pass, for goodness sake, and all this stuff. When you think of an army of 500,000 men, to supply them, to communicate with them, and to imagine a battle in fog when he fought the Russians, and he outflanked the Russians, Austerlitz, and said to his cannon, don't fire on the Russians, they're fleeing across a frozen lake. Bombard the lake. So all the cannonballs fell in the lake and the Russians drowned. Now that's clever. That is very, very clever. His deployment of artillery, he was a superb artillery man, and that was the secret of his success. Now, the great flaw, as far as I'm concerned with Napoleon, he believed in luck. And I always say, weak men believe in luck. Strong men believe in cause and effect. He was also superstitious as well. He had certain days when he would fight, and he knew he would be lucky. And he said to his generals, is he lucky? Now then, I think that's a flaw in my hero.
Can you associate Napoleon, Peter, with a clear, discernible, coherent set of political beliefs, or is he just the big man, the hero who knocks everybody's heads together?
You were talking about the revolution. The revolution is largely over by the time Napoleon comes to power. Right. We're talking about the Directory, who have a different take on the revolution. They're trying to back away from the Terreur. And so Napoleon, in the intervening period, let's take this period from 1795 through to 1800, Napoleon is involved in the first campaign in Italy. He's tremendously successful and creates for himself the idea of this wonderful young general. He then goes off to Egypt, which in the end seems to be a catastrophic failure. Napoleon leaves the army and comes quickly back to France because he hears that things are going badly in France. He arrives, plants his family, who then provide him with a triumphal route up to Paris. He's fated as the victor of Egypt, remarkably enough. And at that point, the Directory is in terrible trouble. Things are going kind of badly. So he allies himself with the right people. He thinks he's going to be the sword in the coup d'etat. And he is the one that finally manages to overthrow the Directory as such and put in place what they call a consular. The consular is involved, has three people at its head, of which Napoleon is first consul. But quite quickly, the second and third consul.
But don't dismiss the Egyptian campaign as a failure, because you nicked the Rosetta Stone.
So much, though. For the
artificial one is in the museum in Cairo, and the one that was nicked by Napoleon is still with you.
And
became first consul. Let's put it again on the line, politically. He established then committees, prefectures, people who knew what they were doing, a meritocracy to govern the whole of France. And to my knowledge, the same system still operates in France today that Napoleon established.
Clearly, Napoleon is the son of the French Revolution in terms of the structures that he puts in place during the consulate period. Yes, you're right to mention the prefecture. I think you mentioned also earlier the Code Civil, which was basically to have been written three times during the revolutionary period. And finally, Napoleon managed to get it written during the consulate period. So, yes, this is yes and no, because by the time you get to the end of the empire, for example, then by that time Napoleon is only largely interested in nobles, and the rank and file are disappearing into the distance.
How did the principles of the revolution sit with what happened on Sunday, the 2nd of December, 1804? Napoleon got up and dressed in white silk and a purple cape lined with Russian ermine, and drove in a coach drawn by 8 bay horses through cheering crowds to the Cathedral of Notre Dame. There, in front of Pope Pius VII, he crowned himself emperor and Josephine empress. Isn't this a complete falling away from everything that the revolution had stood for?
That's another image French children would remember, coronation to start with. Obviously, Napoleon would argue that he needed to put order, continue to put order, that it was a continuation, and sometimes you need a bit of pomp and a lot of direction to maintain the revolutionary heritage. Of course, from then, he had a lot of critics, and that's where his ambivalence, including with the French, was born. And he had a court, he had courtiers, and a lot of people started to resent this.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, Stuart Hall, assisted by our experts Peter Hicks and Isabel Toombs, is proposing the life of Napoleon Bonaparte. Peter, is what Isabel says about the point at which he becomes an ambivalent figure, is that fair?
Absolutely. Napoleon is obsessed with the idea of his own legitimacy. Legitimacy is a kind of buzzword of the 18th and 19th century. Napoleon doesn't have any. His only legitimacy, first of all, is that he took control during the coup d'etat. After that, there are several plebiscites. So people vote, do they want to have Napoleon as the consul for 10 years? And they all vote massively in favour. Voting, of course, is public in those days. You have to write in a book. But anyway, there's a massive vote in his favour. So he's looking for another sort of legitimacy because he wants to have a kind of royal legitimacy. So he thinks, how am I going to do this? The Tribunat and the Conseil d'Etat then decide to say, well, let's vote you in as an emperor. But it must be said that the oath that he swears at the end of the coronation is to uphold the gains of the revolution.
Yes.
So it's a curious mishmash. He's trying to keep sure his own legitimacy up on all sides.
And Isabel would say, she's not attaching herself to this position, but she says that in his defence it's said that he felt the need, so to speak, to create a political narrative, and the white horses and all the rest was part of the political narrative. Does that satisfy you? Stuart, don't you feel that your hero has begun to tarnish?
Not at all, because after Marengo, he gave the Austrians a mighty hammering. He was the hero then. And right about this time, all he wanted to do was to make peace with England. But William Pitt, who was the Winston Churchill of the day, a warmonger of the worst kind, would not accept the peace terms that Napoleon offered. A tall fellow came over to try and make some dialogue with Napoleon, Lord Whitworth, I think he was called, about 6'4", towering over Napoleon, typical English way of making people feel inferior. He dismissed Whitworth and said, I want to give a big smack to the Catholic Church. I'll get the Pope to come from Rome, because Napoleon wouldn't go to Rome. The Pope came to Paris to crown Napoleon Emperor. And he said, right, here I am, England, you've declared war on me, which will go on till one of us actually capitulates. It was the English who made Napoleon the Emperor, because he was pilloried, vilified in the English press as this little yellow man from Corsica, half gypsy, half whatever. And Napoleon said, I am mightier than you, England.
I want to move on to what went wrong, and obviously England comes into that in just a moment, but just to challenge the image that we all seem to have agreed of this enormously self-confident man, this terrifically bold person, believing not just in his own luck but in his own superiority, because here's a letter that he wrote to Josephine from Italy. No letters from you. I only get one every 4 days, whereas if you loved me, you'd write twice a day. But you have to chat with your gentleman callers at 10 in the morning and then listen to the idle talk and silly nonsense of 1,000 fops until an hour past midnight. In countries with morals, everyone is at home by 10 in the evening. But in those countries, people write to their husbands, think of them, live for them. It's an amazingly self-pitying tone here, Isabella, not a confident man at all.
Well, some people said he was a laboratory of psychosis.
explain that to me.
From what people said, he was quite a nervous person. Mm. So whether that was useful militarily, it transformed this energy or his doubt on the military field. But there's a limit to that, probably. And of all people, Antoine de Caunes made a rather interesting film of Napoleon in St. Helena, and you see all of his doubts. I think he was a man who was doubting. He was a man who needed attention, certainly from women.
Peter, let's move now towards the things that went wrong. What would you say went wrong?
The empire itself grows and grows. It's yeah. You probably see the apogee. People generally assume the apogee is about 1810, 1811, when Napoleon marries an Austrian princess. The emperor is finally allied with the Habsburg house, and he has an heir. What I think goes wrong in this sort of period, say 1806 through to 1811, 1812, Napoleon starts not listening to his entourage. I mean, when he went through the consulate, he was a team player. We tend to forget this because we see, as Stuart saying, the myth of the hero. You know, he's the man who makes himself, who does it on his own. And then as you come through the empire, he becomes more autocratic. He starts listening only to himself and not listening to what people, anybody who tempts to say, well, maybe that's not quite such a good idea.
Yeah, but he was harried by the Spanish, the Portuguese, and, of course, the English. Mm. It was the Allies that were ganging up against him, the countries he conquered. There was the uprising there, and
well, I think
you
that
couldn't
he,
keep it down.
Well, also, I think Britain was his real problem. I think he said, all my war started with Britain. Mm. And why did he go to Russia? I'm not sure he had such a huge choice. After all, he tried to convince the Russians, if they didn't come on his side, what was the choice against Britain? I mean, how would he have won against Britain? I think that was his major problem.
Now, just tell us, Stuart, about that Russian campaign.
The Russian campaign.
It was a disaster,
it
wasn't
it? It was a total and utter disaster. He had the Grande Armée of something like 650,000 men, but he couldn't. Hitler fell in the same trap, of course. Mm. The Russian winter defeated him, and the Russians were quite prepared to sacrifice millions of men. You can kill us, you can kill us, and you kill us, and we'll burn the cities there. Smolensk will burn down. Moscow will burn down. You can't beat the Russians. The area's too big, and the Russian winter defeated him. And he didn't have the communication. How can you get the cannon, horse-drawn cannon, and the infantry through the freezing ice and snow and fog? It was doomed, the campaign, before it even started.
But when you say you should have thought about that before it started, I mean, how could he have foreseen? I mean, you could also argue the Russians were as mad, in a sense.
Yes.
In a sense that how could you foresee that the Russians would empty Moscow, Moscow burning, and then he goes back in a dreadful winter, having to cross the Berezina in dreadful conditions. In the middle of winter, it was icy, there were the Cossacks at their back. So the French still nowadays use an expression saying, what a Berezina, when there's a dreadful failure. For instance, you take an exam and you fail badly, you say, well, a complete Berezina.
We say, of course, you met your Waterloo, didn't we?
Which I think is really interesting.
Waterloo
is seen as a catastrophic defeat, not a fabulous victory.
Mm.
We in Britain have taken on the idea of the hubristic defeat, Waterloo's defeat. It's not the great victory of Wellington, it's the catastrophic fall of Napoleon, which is an interesting way of looking at it.
So, Peter, after Moscow, the story moves on, and we find Napoleon exiled, if exile it be, on the island of Elba. What next?
He runs out of money, and so Napoleon thinks, well, either I have to sack my army here on the island of Elba, or I'm going to do something a bit more extraordinary. And what he does is he leaves Elba, enters France by the back door, and with a handful of troops, he makes his way slowly up through France, which is called the Vol de l'Aigle, ends up at Grenoble, where he meets a large part of Louis XVIII's army, and they meet in this field. And Napoleon walks in front of them and says, well, here I am. You can take me if you want, or you can join me. What do you want to do? Since things had been going rather badly in Louis XVIII's France, the troops of Louis XVIII join Napoleon, and then it's a massive triumphal march up to Paris, and Louis XVIII leaves the Tuileries Palace in the morning, and Napoleon enters it in the afternoon, coffee cups supposedly still warm, and it's the 100 days.
This, to me, Peter, Isabel, Stuart, is the point at which I do begin to scent greatness. I've been playing devil's advocate a little, but a lesser man would have been crushed by the episode in Elba, would have thought, well, I've got a pension, I can just stay in Elba, I'll be all right. But to come back after all that and start all over again.
You mentioned you meet the soldiers, and you also said you are not going to shoot on your emperor, and you use the word emperor. So a lot of French people and a lot of soldiers had kept his memory. He still had a huge aura. I mean, who could have managed to go back to Paris from Elba? He did.
Clearly, the people not in power, they do believe the propaganda. He's the father
of the
nation.
But that's the power of the man, isn't he? He has always been charismatic. He's always
carried
the public before him.
I think he was tremendously charismatic, absolutely.
He's overcome the aristocracy and established a meritocracy, a system of government, a brilliant general. And he should have won at Waterloo. And once again, he was let down by his generals. Because, let's put it on the line, Waterloo wasn't won by Wellington. It was won by Blücher, who came in at the right moment on the unguarded flank of Napoleon's army with 35,000 Prussians, and that was that.
Take us through the end game now, Stuart.
The end game was the ultimate defeat when he was incarcerated on St. Helena, and he was looked after by a Dr. O'Meron, who I think was the ship's doctor on the Bellerophon, and he had no one there at all. It was a very lonely life, and he died aged 52 years old in 1821, a very lonely, defeated man. All he had there was the memoirs, and he attempted to tell the truth. Nobody would believe it at all. He was buried in a grave with the headstone reading, "Here lies." It didn't even say Napoleon Bonaparte. Here lies. And then the French, of course, discovered that here was a magical man, one of the great figures of history. So they brought his body back to Paris, to the Invalides, and he was celebrated in France and everywhere throughout the world as one of the great heroes of all time, to rank alongside Julius Caesar, Alexander the Great, Napoleon the Great Hero.
A final question to you, Stuart. Let me put it to you that the flaw in Napoleon's character, which calls into question his true greatness, is that a really great man or woman has a shape to the world which not only inspires but also limits them. Napoleon was one of those people who was just going to go on and on, expanding and expanding, until he went too far and the whole thing came tumbling down. And there's something intellectually very unsatisfactory about the fact that Napoleon himself had no argument for his place in the world, but just to keep conquering and conquering until he fell.
Well, all empires are doomed to failure, aren't they, from the time of the pharaohs and the Romans, the Greeks, the British. So all empires will crumble because eventually people say, well, I am of a certain nationality and I wish to have my voice heard rather than the French voice. But he did want to unify Europe. He conquered 20 countries.
Under himself?
Yes. Well, obviously, there's got to be somebody controlling somewhere.
I mean, you could not have converted Mrs. Thatcher to Europeanism.
Giving,
if she could have been
he was
in
a
control.
Great giver. He gave the world a political system that still exists to this very day.
You could argue that the British won the war on the battlefield, but the French won the war on the front of ideas. And as you said, after all, France was still extremely influential on the intellectual front. When you speak about Egypt, Napoleon was at the origin of Egyptology. He brought a lot of scientists.
Of course.
That was the beginning of a great science. So he may not have, after all, lost the war.
But he left
the battle.
He left his mark round the world.
Yes, I think, but it could have been better. I think that's the point. You see, basically, he didn't know when to
stop.
When to negotiate. If there was what they call in French the fuite en avant. It's this flight, always forward, always forward. If he'd known when to call in, if he'd known to negotiate, if he'd known to say to the satellite kingdoms, yes, you can have a bit more power, he could have made a greater France. The French border could have been the Rhine. But because he just didn't know when to stop, he blew it.
Well, I do know where to stop. Our time is up. So thanks to our guest, Stuart Hall, to our expert witnesses, Isabel Toombs and Peter Hicks, for exploring with us a great life that it's remarkable, and the oddity is worth a programme in itself, that this series has never examined before, Napoleon Bonaparte. Goodbye.